Hello and welcome to Brain Injury Bites, where we provide help and advice for people after a brain injury. Hi, I'm Ashwani and I'm a trustee at Headway Warrington. I'm also a senior associate solicitor focusing on catastrophic injury, including brain injury.
My name's Brooke and I've lived with a traumatic brain injury since 2007.
Thank you for returning to listen to part two of this interview.
I remember hearing about, like you said, about people, you know, people you've worked with and how severe they are. One, the big thing for me was, like, as I said, I didn't think I had anything wrong with me. I remember thinking, like, there's people much worse off than me, and I can't be getting anything out of this. You know, a time would be much better spent with somebody much more severe than myself.
Yeah, I've heard that when I worked for the NHS in the acute phase, and I think severity is very subjective.
Yeah.
So, you know, scorings on assessment don't then relate to how much input somebody needs.
Yeah.
It's about quality of life. And this is why I have a great passion for working with people with very subtle difficulties, because, you know, in previous experience that was often missed, and I'd identify that in people because it has a massive impact on day-to-day life, forming and maintaining relationships, going back into the workplace. So this is where I would work with a large spectrum. I mean, if somebody's extremely severe but has no insight, is, you know, really happy, has reached a plateau, they may actually have less input and more of a scaffolding and a supportive approach than somebody who wants to get back into work. So it's a real continuum, and but I can understand how you felt, because I've heard that a lot. You know, I it was a unit that I worked in, so I want to go home. I'm not like the rest of the people here.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's that insight. But some people who were very severe also said that as well.
And one thing from not getting that venison deer joke, that was something I, like, realised that I just missed the joke. And I remember in conversation, you know, because you want to get back into the swing of things, don't you? And I remember me not following stories and not getting jokes, and that's something that really bothered me. And I sort of developed this obsession with stand-up comedy, which I'm still a fan of now.
But, that's your strategy.
So I mean, I'm still kind of, and I've been to see loads of different comedians and stuff.
That's good. And I think, you know, as you say, you really identified that, which was brilliant. You had the insight. And you can imagine sometimes misinterpretation of humour can lead to conflict as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, some clients may have quite significant behavioural difficulties or disinhibition, as you were saying, Ashwini, with swearing and, you know, but quite aggressively. So again, I've worked with a client who would come across quite abrupt on messages or face-to-face, and it was very much teaching that person to maybe just lighten something with an emoji or, you know, looking at facial expression, because we could say the same thing in completely different ways. And I always give an example of, you know, if I said to my children, come here, how am I feeling? I'm feeling they've run something, you know, I'm annoyed at something. If I said to them, oh, come here, and obviously I'm smiling, that's more playful.
That's the thing that you don't get in text messages as well. That can always be misinterpreted. I mean, now there's the eventual emojis and you can let it.
That's a bit better,
but, back in the day, it was just like hard text,
just
wasn't
words,
it?
Yeah. And you might have, you know, any of us could misinterpret something written, you know, and that would have been more so probably for you. You know, you'd have read something, is this person be funny or are they not?
I mean, the amount of anxiety I've had about other, because I've always had this thing that I'm not, you know, I'm different, I'm not accepted. And you want to, because all you try to do, I'm trying to get to that person that I was the day before the accident happened.
Mm.
And that's where I think it's difficult, because, you know, you've got your friends who are striving in their careers and wanting to aim for this particular job, this role in this in the career. But at the same time, you're just trying to get back to where you were before. So you're almost going backwards while everyone else is going forwards. And I just found that it's just socially that creates a big divide as well. And then you're trying to fit in with them and you're almost making stuff up and lying and just trying to, do you know what I mean?
That must be incredibly difficult. And I think that's because you had insight. So that must make it even harder in a way, because from listening to kind of your examples, you seem to withdraw more. So you were probably more passive and quieter than you were prior to your injury. Mm. Sometimes the opposite happens and people are louder, more dominant. And that really breaks down relationships if somebody's, you know, quite aggressive, quite resilient. But you suffered in this journey yourself, didn't you? Because you were kind of thinking, I'm not fitting in, maybe want to avoid them, I'm going to nip into a shop. And, you know, hopefully by you going through the rehab journey and being and seeing, if I put myself in this situation, what's going to happen? Oh, I had a positive outcome. And I, you know, in my therapy, I do a lot of the impairment therapy, and by the impairment, I mean specific tasks. But I always do social sessions as well, because I feel that that's great. It's kind of as a rapport between therapist and client, and also it's really great to practice the skills and mixes it up a little bit.
One thing my mum and dad used to go on at me all the time is they used to call it the ear mate theory. Like I was, if we were, I don't know, in a restaurant or shop or whatever, you wanted the waiter's attention or something, I was like, excuse me, mate. It got the waiter's attention, so I was just like, yeah, see? But they were saying it's rude, you know, wait till the person's finished speaking until you boom your voice down the throat. And it's just like, to me, you know, they'd come over and do the bill, whatever we wanted their attention for. And I couldn't really see a problem with it. But obviously my parents were saying, oh my God.
Yeah, and that's obviously something you wouldn't have done before.
They were saying the social element to it and stuff and the embarrassment.
Yeah. And that's the disinhibition, isn't it, a little bit? But you're now aware of that. That's not something you'd do.
You've talked about dysarthria and you've also touched upon dyspraxia, but the other two sort of terms I hear quite a lot are aphasia and dysphagia. So I was just wondering if you would be able to just explain that to our audience, what they are, what the differences are, and again, how you would rehabilitate people presenting with those.
Yeah, so dysphagia and aphasia are quite fluid. It's just the level of severity, really. Obviously, there's a dysphagia with a G, which is the swallowing, which I've kind of touched on briefly. So the dysphagia is the comprehension, the understanding, so the communication model I was talking about with understanding spoken language, so the comprehension of language, the ability to understand the meaning of words, use words, and the reading and writing. So the very linguistic kind of traditional areas of speech and language therapy as well. I suppose an area actually we've not touched on is dysphonia, so a voice difficulty. Yeah. That's quite a separate area on its own of speech and language therapy. So that's an area I've worked in previously for clients not related to any brain injury. So, you know, teachers, hairdressers, people who are straining the voice. Mm. However, we do come across this quite a bit with people with post-brain injury, and it links very much to dysarthria as well. So again, you know, projecting the voice, being able to use breath support, sometimes post-trachea, so intubation, there can be a little bit of scarring. So again, it's sometimes getting referral to, so the scarring sort of externally on your neck, but there can be sometimes irritation of the vocal cords.
So something that we never got confirmation of was I used to have, I probably still do have it, a cough. And I mean, it used to be much more severe than it is now, because I'm socially aware of it now. But we didn't know whether that was when the tubes were put down my throat.
Coughs are always really difficult to identify, but there can be different reasons. And again, because I've kind of come from a previously worked within voice as well, there can be a slight reflux side to, so heartburn side to cough. And sometimes medications can cause a little bit of heartburn. So it's a dry cough. Or there can be what we call sort of a globus sensation, or feeling of something in your throat. Mm. That can also be reflux. But yeah, it could be what we call a bit of a tethering, a bit of scar tissue, and you feel something there.
That's what we thought it must have
been. Yeah, it can also be a sign of the dysphagia as well, swallowing, but obviously not in your case. But if I, you know, speech therapists really listen out for coughing, if it's linked to a drinking or eating, to think, has something gone into the lungs? Mm. As soon as something, sorry, I feel like I've gone back to dysphagia.
No.
As soon as something hits the vocal cords, they're a safety mechanism. They want to push it out of the airway, and that's the cough.
I think I would always do that, but I just know now socially how annoying it can be.
No, it is
annoying for myself, because I've heard myself, what I said about videoing yourself, and I've seen myself on video, I heard myself on recordings, and you just think, oh my God, that sounds awful.
It could be something developed as a habit as well. So sometimes that can be linked to voice. If we all think, you know, traditionally, if people say, right, get ready for public speaking, clear your throat, take a deep breath in, that's the opposite of what you do to project your voice. You know, we don't kind of clear our throat. But that might have been what you were doing to either get rid of a sensation or to get your voice ready to project. Because if you're mindful of it and stopping it, it's not kind of an uncontrolled reflexive cough, is it? It must be a might be, have started as that, but then become a bit of a habit.
It's been really interesting because, like, listening to the things that you've been talking about, I can see how there's so much interaction with the role of an occupational therapist or the role of a neuropsychologist. And, you know, particularly when you're talking about the wider aspects of speech and language therapy, you know, improving people's memory, their social language, their cognitive communication, building up confidence, as we've spoken about, and, you know, looking at things like the interaction of cognitive fatigue with all the rehabilitation that you're trying to do. I can see that there's a real role for a multidisciplinary team of you all coming together. But I guess in a way, it just kind of, it feels like sometimes it could be a complete overlap. How do you sort of work together to make sure that you are working towards the same thing, but not necessarily all doing the same thing?
Yeah, I think it's maybe some of it's with experience, kind of knowing the area that's specifically linked to your own role. So and sometimes it's deciding who does a role as well, because I think I feel social communication therapy works very well from a speech therapy point of view. Sometimes psychologists may think that that's an area, but I think from working, every neuropsychologist I've worked with, we've worked really well together, and I've kind of taken that area on board, and they may deal with behaviours, and we've done a lot of joint. There was a really good example of a client where there was joint neuropsychology and speech and language therapy guidelines around behaviour. So I very much looked at what phrases people should use to prompt the client, to encourage things that the client should say that's appropriate. You know, and the psychologist was more around looking at the triggers, looking. So that's where they kind of, where they're separate. The same with occupational therapy. So I would look at being able to understand abstract language, communicate in different situations. So if I did a joint session with an occupational therapist, they'd be looking at the ability to navigate around a shop or a cafe, you know, knowing a structure of where to queue up. I'd be looking at the social appropriateness, ability to read the menu. They may look at the money management. So they're kind of the areas where they overlap, but are quite different roles, but knit very nicely into interdisciplinary team working.
You mentioned that you like to sort of introduce games sometimes into... Can we have a go?
Yeah, of course we can. So we could do where... I mean, some of them are actual games like Articulate, Don't Say the Word. The Don't Say the Word is a favourite. I often find these games because I look for kind of my older daughter for game, then I think... I'm having this for work. It's actually a really good language game. So one of the games might be where we think of an object and then you've got to find out what the object is.
Okay.
So if I think of an object, you need to kind of categorise your questions as in, is it in the building?
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah. Okay. So I'll think I've thought of an object. So how can we find out what object? So,
is it in the building?
Yes.
Is it in a kitchen?
No.
Is it in this room?
Yes.
Is it a person?
No.
Is it electronic?
No. I'll try not to make it too easy, but it's not too hard. So it's thinking, how else can we categorise to find out what it is? You've already done a great job. Sometimes people just guess and I'm like, no.
Is it made out of glass?
No.
Okay.
Is it made out of plastic?
Yes.
Is it something you can write with?
Yes.
Yes, it's a pen.
Yeah. There we go. And I always say, sometimes when I introduce games, and honestly, I've done games with all sorts of clients that you might not have enjoyed them, and sometimes like this, and by the end, I mean, I think they just think she's way too excited by this game, you know, I'm like, these are Christmas games that we should play every day, and it brings out fun, and sometimes like, the clients will choose really difficult ones, and I'm like, we're not playing this again if we're going to make it too difficult.
Yeah.
Is that, how does that happen? Is that just like... A bit like the different objects in the bathroom, is it?
Yeah, so what that's doing is, it's... So if you were the one thinking of an object, you've got to think of an object. Yeah. I suppose you've got visual cues, but if you did something outside, you're already thinking of... Like, you're generating a word, you're thinking. If you're asking the questions, you're generating questions. You've got to give closed questions that are only a yes or no.
Right.
And you've got to categorise.
It's making you think, is it?
Yeah, it's making you think. So it's doing what we call your semantic system.
Right.
Because you could have just said, is it a glass? Is it a hand gel?
Yeah.
Is it a TV? And when people do that, and I have to say, let's think of categories. And you did that. Is it electronic? You know, is it in the room? Is it furniture? Is it plastic? And that itself is your brain working and categorising.
So that reminds me of something that we used to do with my speech and language therapist, Lucy. We used to do, because I mentioned that I had, my voice was really low and it was there was no melody to it. Mm-hmm. So it was something to combat that. It was, she called it whooping and booming. I don't know if that's a proper technique or that was her version of it. But we used to have to start, we used to almost plot it on a graph. So if you can think about a graph going down, start at the bottom, and we used to go like the deepest voice possible to go, and you say, if you're going up, you say the word whoop. So you say, you stay like whoop, and then opposites, you would go say the word boom. So it would go boom. Sounds like one of them.
Yeah.
Jazz.
So that's going back to the dysarthria or the voice therapy. So it's looking at the pitch and volume areas of your voice box.
We do that as part of like singing warm-ups and choir and stuff.
I'm sure,
Sort of trying to, it's almost like a roller coaster, but it is just to kind of get your voice.
Yeah, we used to have to plot it on a graph. Up and down.
Sometimes
you'd start in the middle and then you go to the top and you go to the bottom and then remain back on the middle.
And that's exercising your vocal cords.
Mm. Yeah.
Vocal cords, when we're lower in pitch, the thicker and fatter. And when we're higher in pitch, the longer and thinner.
Okay.
Mm. So it's, you would have done that more of an extreme, as you say, because in speech we don't need to woo up and down.
Yeah.
But then that would have started to become the norm of enabling your voice to go up and down during conversation.
I remember having difficulty like getting a smooth transition from the bottom to the top, and you sort of.
Yeah. So it's the control, isn't it? So it's it was probably a combination of the breath support and the strength and movement of the vocal cords.
Okay.
Yeah, it probably would be one, wouldn't it, and then go quickly up, or, you know, not a kind of a progression. When we assess, we look at progression within pitch. Can it go up in equal progression? Same with volume.
Yeah, that's literally what I had. It was a melody and volume of my voice.
So you can kind of see in how much detail speech and language therapists work with people, because we are very characteristic. We're known via our voices, aren't we? So if somebody... Yeah. Does a voice, you know, takes on somebody, you know, an actor's voice, you're like, oh, wow, that's really good. You really sound like them. You know, if you answer the phone, if you didn't see the name and you heard someone's voice, you would know it was them.
When you say it to
it's very
parent,
unique.
Yeah, if you're a parent, either it's me, and it's just like, you know.
Or just her, yeah. So we do identify people.
Do you, I mean, just coming back to your whooping and booming and talking about melody and pitch and so on, do you use singing at all in speech and language therapy?
Yeah, sometimes, and it could be that we work on that for voice. It could be just to engage somebody. So I've worked with music with the clients with prolonged disorders of consciousness. So you're very, clients that are diagnosed as minimally conscious, and sometimes that will evoke a response.
Mm.
Or it can just be used, I also use it as a distractor, with music, as in music on in the background, to work on attention with somebody. And it's just something to engage people. So if there's a nice, you know, a song on. I mean, songs, again, are stored very differently.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like children. They can sing nursery rhymes before they can speak because it's a melody. People with severe dementia can often retain and access songs from years ago, but they can't communicate.
Yeah, dementia is... Yeah.
So it can be a way in. Can be a way
in. Yeah, I went to a really interesting exhibition actually yesterday about the power of music. And there were the sort of examples given there where people were perhaps nonverbal or just, you know, struggling to articulate words, but were able to articulate through song, or it was just provoking very emotive responses in patients with dementia, that sort of thing. Because, as you say, it's stored in a different place. And
it can just bring joy, I think, and familiarity. And I cover a neuro rehab unit as well, a private one, and they have a music therapist there. So speech and language therapy and music therapy will sometimes work jointly.
Yeah.
Again, to kind of look at breath support, maybe sometimes singing from a voice point of view,
diaphragmatic
kind of
breathing.
Looking at responses. So, if somebody's very, very low awareness, are they responding when there's certain music? So, yeah, it definitely plays a role.
You can see the link there, though. Okay, it's quite easy to see the link between music therapy and speech and language.
Mm.
And I think, you know, I've had people be able to project the voice so they can go back on karaoke. My outcome measure was, how were you on karaoke? You know, and all the feedback was, hey, I managed to reach the notes, or I got that song, or I can project across, speak to my friends in a pub when it's
karaoke
noisy.
Is a whole different. I mean, I like to think that I'm not the best singer, but I can sing. But karaoke, I can't sing.
No, and I'm glad I'm not in that situation. Yeah, I'm glad I can pass that over to the client and I don't have to be there to, you know, lead the way. There you go.
It's one of them things that there's a lovely lady called Elva in Didsbury that I've had help with my public speaking off, and I would like to be able to sing. I think the desire came from Canada. I've got a friend in Canada, and I went to meet her at the bar that she was working at, and they had like a karaoke night on there, and then, my God, the difference in Canadian karaoke and English karaoke. So I'm from Scarborough,
yeah,
and seaside town, and you should see the level, or rather the low level of talent on the the low level of talent matched with the high level of enthusiasm of the drunk people. Yeah, the drunk people in a pub called the Newcastle Packet on the Scarborough Seafront. And there was these people in Canada, like, they took it so seriously. And I mean, I got up and I did a meatloaf song and I absolutely murdered it. But I just thought, everybody would get on with it. I thought that's what he did.
But it was like,
and the guy was doing it, compared or whatever it was. And he was like, okay, so anybody, and moved me on very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody was like a stunned silence. And people would go and have singing lessons during the week so they could perform better at this karaoke. And honestly, people thought there was like no sense of humour whatsoever.
There you go, yeah. And it's different, culturally different, isn't it?
And there's like, I've got a friend, Holly, who's like a professional singer. And she were all out for a friend's birthday ages ago, and she'd done this number on karaoke, and she sung this amazing song. And like, people were like practically coming in off the street to see what was going on. And I remember the guy saying, "Wow, how do you follow that?" I said, "I'll tell you how we'll follow that. We're Mickey." And this little guy comes up, staggers up, and he sung Wild Thing. And that's
nice.
That's fun.
That's been really interesting, Catherine and Brooke, actually, listening to both of you and just listening to your experiences and the sort of the ways in which you support clients, Catherine. Just to sort of, I guess, wrap it up, what do you think a common misconception is about the role of a speech and language therapist?
I think the most traditional opinion is it's elocution.
Mm.
And I always say, you know, I have an accent. I don't think I'd particularly be in the role of a speech and language therapist if it was elocution. So we get a lot of how now, brown cow, so I think it's about the speech. People think it's how your speech sounds.
Rather than how you're...
Yeah, yeah.
And I think exactly what I thought it was at first, yeah.
So swallowing's not mentioned in there, is it? Voice and all these higher level language difficulties.
Well, I think you've definitely, over the course of this session, I think you've definitely shown us that it's most certainly not elocution. Well, thank you so much for coming in. I've really enjoyed listening to both of you
today.
We will put your contact details on the notes to this episode, so if anyone has any questions, wants to get in touch, then you can do so. But thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been really enjoyable. Thank you, Brooke, for again making my role within this podcast very easy.
Oh, thank you very much. It was something that I'd say out of my therapy, all the different therapies I had, it was one of the ones I enjoyed the most, or one of the ones I engaged with the most. Good. I guess, yeah.
Please don't forget to follow, subscribe and share our content. If you do have any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to cover, why not drop us a line at hi@braininjurybites.co.uk.